The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we have a great show for you today, and I know I say that a lot, but I really mean it. This is one I've been wanting to do for a while on a subject that I think is extremely valuable for those old dog investors out there that are looking for the right kind of real estate investment to get involved in, but maybe they're, maybe not really ready for the tenants and trash and all that stuff that's involved with the rental property. So our guest today is Hunter Thompson. He's a full-time real estate investor and founder of Cashflow Connections. Since starting CFC, Cashflow Connections, Hunter has helped investors allocate capital to over 100 properties, which have a combined asset value of over $350 million. His experience includes investments in self-storage facilities, residential mortgage notes, mobile home parks, single family acquisitions, hard money loans, office buildings, and multifamily real estate syndications. In connection with these investments, he has worked with some of the most experienced and well-respected asset teams across the United States and Canada. Hunter is also the host of the Cashflow Connections Real Estate Podcast, which helps investors learn the intricacies of commercial real estate from the comfort of their homes. Well, Hunter, what a great background. We are really excited to have you here. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Bill, can't thank you enough. It's an honor to be on the program. So thanks a lot for having me.
Well, we're excited to have you. You have definitely a broad background. It's not just in self-storage, but you've agreed to kind of focus in on that area because I think it's one that there's a lot of questions people have and probably a lot of misconceptions and other things that hopefully you'll be able to clarify as well. But Hunter, I'd be real interested just kind of know your background, how you got involved in real estate investing.
Yeah, sure. So, like a lot of people listening, I think I was very much a young entrepreneur at heart. I think that, a lot of the entrepreneurship stuff, some people talk about, selling books and tapes out of their car, selling burnt CDs out of their car. That's the kind of stuff that I was doing at a very young age. My parents had a a house that was very near a venue, a concert venue. And so I would always sell parking spaces to the venue whenever there was a concert there. So like that was kind of my background. And then, you know, I was really interested in economics in college and studied economics. And like most people that study economics, it didn't play a lot of real world. It didn't help me a big amount in the real world, but I was interested in the topic. So when 2008 happened, I was very much in tune with kind of paying attention to those economic metrics. And this was really, you know, obviously this is when the big paradigm shift happened with a lot of people that were investing at the time. But for me, that's just when I realized it could be profitable. I knew that there was going to be profit. I didn't know if it was going to be in stocks. I didn't know if it was going to be in real estate. I didn't know what the investment idea was going to be. I knew this was just a rare opportunity that I needed to take advantage of. And it didn't really click for me 100% until a couple years later. So 2010 or so is when I really started to realize that real estate was just such a great tool. Generally, and this is a lot to do with the fact that this is when the European debt crisis started to happen and really take hold. And so for those of you that weren't paying attention at the time, basically, you know, we were watching CNBC, and I remember them talking about how the Greece bond yields needed to stay below 7%. But if they went above 7%, the S&P 500 was going to collapse. And I was just thinking, like, how in the world are the Greece bond yields playing any role whatsoever, let alone a significant role in my financial well-being? And this really led me to really focus outside of stocks, cycle outside of the stocks, and to try to diversify into some really simple, low-risk, you know, cash flow-focused investments. And real estate, obviously, is the number one driver of those. So that's kind of my introduction there in terms of that asset class as a whole.
Oh, that's neat. Now, where did you start? At what level of real estate investing?
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing that I kind of took advantage of was that there just wasn't any lending going on at the time, right? That's the whole point with 2008 specifically. So I began by lending money to real estate investors that were buying properties to flip them at very low loan to values in markets that were very, very stable. So markets like Memphis, Tennessee is where I made my first investment. Just lending a property, you know, the property was purchased for $70,000. So we'd lend $50,000 in the property, so less than the purchase price. And then the buyer would put another $20,000 or so into it. And so we'd be in the property at like a 50% loan to value once the property was tenanted at least or fixed. And so, you know, I was thinking, you know, in the history of Memphis, they've never suffered a 30% price correction in this price point. So it would have to take a once in a lifetime type of correction. And this is already after, you know, the most significant downturn in the history, you know, of the United States in terms of real estate. So I thought I was very well protected, and those investments, you know, did end up working out quite well. The problem is, of course, that the lending markets change and the market itself has changed. So now the rates that were available at that time aren't available now. But, you know, from a risk adjusted basis, I think those are some of the best investments I ever made, just because they're very simple and collateralized by hard assets, particularly real estate.
Oh, that's neat. Well, obviously, you made a shift into other areas. I mean, you talk about everything from, you know, multifamily here, hard money loans, office buildings. But I think the area that we really want to zero in on is how did you get involved in self-storage?
Yeah, so, you know, I like you mentioned, I invested in all the typical asset classes, and this is mostly passively, right, or almost exclusively passively. So I'll defer to a sponsor's expertise on multifamily, retail, office, et cetera. But the reality is I'm very cyclically concerned. I'm very concerned about recessions, not only from a price perspective, but also from a demand perspective. Is there going to be a lot of demand for a A-class multifamily apartment if there's a significant correction in the overall economy? And I started to become more concerned with this as prices started to increase. So in 2013 or so, I really started taking a really hard look at what I consider to be recession-resistant assets, most notably mobile home parks and self-storage facilities. And so really the key driver here is that these asset classes, the demand for the product is extremely stable and can even increase during recessions. So you think about the reasons people use self-storage. Most of the time, they're going through some change in their life, some kind of transitional period. And a lot of these transitional periods can be brought on by recessions. So you think about the things that people moving, people getting laid off, job changes, foreclosures, et cetera. All of these are more common during recessions, and all of them make people more likely to be self-storage tenants. So I'm kind of looking at that, and that's the thesis, right? I mean, there's all these big, big sweeping theses in real estate, but that one made a lot of sense to me from a big picture perspective. And I kind of looked at the data, the historical data. The asset class is relatively young, but the data lines up very well with that thesis. In fact, from the mid-90s to the mid-2010s, the asset class as a whole essentially doubled. The number of self-storage facilities doubled, more than doubled, from about 20,000 to more than 50,000. And during that time, occupancy rates remained high. Asking rental income for 10 by 10 units, for example, continued to increase significantly, both through the 2001 and 2008 recession. So essentially, as the asset class was doubling, occupancy rates remained high and asking rents remained high. So I was, you know, I was really hooked at that point, and then I started diving in to more of the details. But that's kind of, you know, my introduction to self-storage was I just trying to build stable cash flow for the long term. I think it provides a great vehicle for that.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, the first property that you actually purchased. How did you find it? What were you looking for in that market? What were the criteria primarily for you to purchase your first unit?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just to clarify, you know, what I specialize is being a passive investor in these type of asset classes. So the first thing that I'm really concerned with is the sponsor themselves. I mean, the mass majority of the due diligence I'm looking for is based on the person I'm making a bet on, particularly the management company, the management team behind the asset. I set up and Cashflow Connections sets up investment vehicles for passive investors that aren't trying to be full-time investors. So I align myself with them in that sense. The first thing I'm looking for is, am I making a bet on the right person? And what is their track record like? And can they verify the claims that they're making? And most importantly, are they putting themselves in a position to under-promise and over-deliver, or vice versa, right? Because one of those is great, and the other one is completely unacceptable. If you're thinking that you're going to get an 8% return, you get a 10% return, that's great. But if you're anticipating getting a 17% return, you get an 8% return, your financial planning is just completely out the window. So that's my honest answer to that question. However, you know, in terms of markets, I'd say that there's a certain markets that make sense. It's all about the economics of the market, right? It's all about math and numbers and not anything about emotion. And it just so happens that with self-storage, in terms of markets, a lot of the opportunities that I have seen in the last 5 years or so have been in the Southeast because of a combination of the fact that there's generally a lot of jobs going to that area. There's a lot of demographic shifts, particularly in places like Florida, where older generations are moving there, and retirees, baby boomers, they make for great tenants with self-storage in particular, because a lot of them are downsizing and therefore they need to keep their stuff, but they want to live in smaller quarters. You can see how that kind of plays into that model there. Charlotte, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, et cetera. And then I can go into some of the details as far as what I look for in a perfect asset, but that's kind of a big picture perspective. You know, that's where I believe the value is in the asset class.
Well, yeah. Why don't you go into that area? I'd like to hear that.
Sure. So, you know, I think that the key here is that the tenant base itself is extremely sticky. So what I mean by that is, because the gross dollars is relatively insignificant, you know, when you're talking about rental increases, let's say if the property is being rented for $100 a month for a 10 by 10 unit, if you raise the rent 6%, the tenant base is barely going to even notice. But for you guys that are investing in other asset classes, a 6% rental increase is extremely favorable, right? Especially over the long term. But when you're talking about $6, the question is, you know, is this tenant going to take the day off work, hire movers, get a rental truck, pack all their stuff up, drive down the street, where they're probably going to do the same thing anyway? And, you know, over the long term, we have found the answer is no. So basically, you've got this really sticky tenant base, and the combination of that with just a lot of really mismanaged properties out there. So earlier I mentioned that the asset class basically doubled. A lot of those managers are single property managers. So they don't have all the systems in place that a top tier sponsor would have. So really what this adds up to is you've got all of these mismanaged properties in a really sticky tenant base, but the complexities of the asset class is such that you can add significant value without significant capital expenditure very quickly. So you can buy a property that's significantly under market rent, significantly underoccupied in certain circumstances, and add value by increasing those economics. But you can also implement things like marketing, sales, SEO. You can leverage relationships with U-Haul, which it can be really lucrative. So, you know, just really quickly for the listeners, in the self-storage model, it's possible to allow U-Haul or a competitor to park their trucks on your facility, and then you rent out the truck to the tenants, and you take a commission from U-Haul or a competitor for facilitating that transaction. That right there can add, you know, I've invested in properties where that one line item has gone from $0 a month to $3,500 a month within 6 months. And that's with zero capital expenditure. And so there's just all these little line items that can really add to the complexities of the asset class. But as you add these line items, you're adding more things that mom and pop operators cannot do effectively. So the complexities of the asset class make it very lucrative in the sense that the discrepancy between a mom and pop operator and a best-in-class operator is very significant.
That's great. That's really neat. And I think this sort of value-add component is something that I know nothing about, but you've just given me a little education there. How do you go about finding your deals?
Yeah, so again, just, you know, top-tier sponsors. And these are people that have been in the business for decades with hundreds of millions of dollars transacted. And, you know, the combination of on-market and off-market transactions. And, you know, one of the keys with self-storage is that it can be a little deceiving because of some of the things I mentioned earlier with U-Haul and significant discrepancies between economic and physical occupancy, et cetera. You can find a property that most experienced investors would say, where's the value add here? So, you know, I'll give you an example. There'd be an on-market transaction that's 90% occupied in a market that's 91% occupied. Right there, I mean, most experienced investors would say, you know, I'm going to spend my time doing other things besides trying to get that extra 1%, right? Well, self-storage, there is so much going on under the hood that can make that discrepancy between the physical occupancy, what's rated at, and the economic occupancy because of each of these line items. So the deal flow can be a little bit, it can be interesting because there's plenty of deals out there that are on market that people have passed on because of the fact that they don't have the systems in place or aren't privy to, you know, the different ways to add value to the property.
Now, are your sponsors, the people that are that are going after these deals, are they going the traditional route through commercial brokers, direct mail? I mean, what kind of ways are they getting their leads from?
Yeah, all of the above. And I'd say that, you know, when you're in, let's say you're in the top 50 sponsors in the country, which is usually what we're looking for in any asset class that we look at, any deal that's taking place, you're going to be aware of essentially. But also, you know, it's funny, the best deals in the world come from the most random situations. Like someone will be on vacation and just see a facility that doesn't have U-Haul. I mean, the U-Haul thing cannot be overstated. That right there, you know, if you compound that with a property that doesn't have mandatory tenant insurance, which can add another $1,500 a month or so, it's basically renter's insurance. You know, the combination of those two things right there, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars of equity you can add to a property without capital expenditure. And the reason I mentioned that last part is because on a risk-adjusted basis, which is what I'm always focused on, that is quite favorable from an investor's perspective.
That's great. So you can actually sell insurance to the people that are renting the storage spaces from you.
Exactly. And when you have many, many properties, the economies of scale starts to make sense. So the commissions become larger and, you know, the system really oils itself, basically.
I love it. Well, as a passive investor, you obviously are looking for a certain kind of return and expected hold period for these properties. What would be attractive to you, or what would you look for in a self-storage investment?
Yeah. So, you know, I'd say that, first of all, because of, you know, the historical data, these investments make great long-term investments.
That's what I would
If you're able to continue to just raise rents and continue to increase the occupancies and continue to increase the efficiencies, you know, I'm not really sure why people would want to sell. I think that, you know, a lot of the thing when people ask about time horizon, they're less concerned with selling than they are with returning their capital. So if we could potentially both return capital and increase the and keep the asset, I think that would be ideal. That's of course depending on, you know, the ability to refinance, et cetera. But, you know, to answer your question, we usually talk about 7 to 10 year time horizons. And we want to be conservative in our numbers, and I think that time is one of those ones that's really important to be conservative in. I think that 7 to 10 years is enough time to buy a property, implement these value add strategies effectively, and then sell at favorable market timing. The last part in particular is something that's difficult to control. So I think that that 7 to 10 year window is enough to not only implement those strategies, but weather any kind of economic storm, particularly as it pertains to the capital markets, which are going to play a big role in the value of the property.
And what kind of return are you looking for?
Yeah, you know, we target low to mid teens for our investors. And, you know, that's kind of the range that I'm happy with. You know, we'll forego year one, year two cash flow for later returns, particularly adding value to a property. So like a great example of this is their climate controlled units are a little bit more expensive, and they have the ability to keep the units stay within a very narrow range in terms of the degrees temperature that the items are kept. So this is good for like things like art or family heirlooms or et cetera, things that may expand and contract, clothing, et cetera. So one of the value add strategies is to buy properties that don't have climate controlled units and add these climate controlled units to the property. It's a great upsell. It allows people to, you know, have, they come in based on the price that's for the standard units, and they see the climate controlled units. You can see how this kind of plays out there. So, you know, essentially, if you're able to buy a property based on in-place income and then add those climate-controlled units, I think that we're willing to forego that year one cash flow while that expansion is taking place to add that value. So that'll kind of give you an idea.
Well, that makes sense. So for your typical, say, 7 to 10 year hold, what kind of an IRR are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, somewhere in that same range, you know, low to mid teens. I'd say that, you know, low teens is kind of where we're trying to end up there.
Okay, great, great. So some specific questions, because I've actually looked at self-storage, and there's some just questions that loom that you have to think about. You know, one of them is the advantage, you'd say, was, well, you don't have the tenants and trash issue. You know, the people, they just rent the space from you. But you know, you have to, if somebody doesn't pay, you've still got that issue. You've got to, I would assume at some point, if you don't collect for them, you would, auction off the whatever's in their unit. And, you know, do you ever get repercussions, people that, you know, get really upset and, you know, come back to retaliate or what have you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a good question. I'd say that a lot of the stuff you see on TV, particularly, is a result of really bad management, right? So you think about the thing that is key with the asset class is that they're 30-day leases. So if you buy a property that's really mismanaged and the tenant base is, let's say, used to paying really late or keeping the place kind of junky, within 30 days, those tenants are pretty much gone. I mean, within 90 days for sure. So if you buy a property that's really mismanaged and say, if you don't pay within 5 days, you're getting a significant late fee, and we're going to actually administer that late fee as opposed to the previous manager. The property can turn around within 3 months for sure. So a lot of the problems with having non-paying tenants is a result of mismanagement. Having said that, the very much unlike the laws related to residential properties, particularly in states like California, the laws are much more favorable for the self-storage owner than the tenant. And this is key because of it allows you to evict tenants very quickly, lock their items if they don't pay, et cetera, without going through lengthy litigation processes. And anybody that's dealt with that process as an owner of residential real estate knows that this can make a big difference, especially if you're, you know, doing this over a big scale or a large portfolio.
Right. Now, so how important is security? Do you have on-site guards? Have you ever had break-ins on properties that you've been involved with?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any break-ins. I'd say that part of the reason for that is that I specifically invest in Class A properties, and kind of the difference between Class A, B, and C is basically kind of some of the stuff you're kind of alluding to, the amenities, and security is a big portion of that. So with Class A properties, there's going to be 24-hour security tapes. There's going to be 24-hour lighting, 24-hour entrance. There's going to be an on-site property manager that actually lives on the property. So, you know, you kind of add these things up. It's not as clearly defined as it is with something like multifamily, but just to kind of finish that thought out, visibility, covered RV spaces, security gates, et cetera. You know, those are the kind of things that are going to kind of differentiate a Class A to a Class B to a Class C. So, in terms of security, yeah, that's a major one. The majority of the self-storage tenants are actually women. So safety is a number one priority, and making sure that the tenants feel safe is a number one priority for us.
Yeah, I would imagine on your value add, you know, just putting in the right kind of security is really key, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. And the appearance as well. I mean, people can tell when you go into a property if it's maintained, if the attention to detail is such that everything is kind of taken care of, you feel safer just because you know that someone's paying attention to the asset.
Right. A few years back, one of my favorite TV shows, you talk about television, it's one of my favorite TV shows was 24. And it always seemed that these terrorists, okay, were storing like nuclear armaments in self-storage facilities, okay? What about illegal activities? I mean, people storing drugs or illegal, you know, stolen items, things like this. I mean, is this a concern of people that own the units?
Yeah, I mean, we have heard some crazy stories. I mean, something that happens that's not even that infrequent is people that create gyms that they're not supposed to do that. They create a gym, basically their private gym as a self-storage unit. And then obviously the concerns about drugs and, you know, prostitution, stuff like that. But, you know, to be honest with you, a lot of that stuff, again, is a result of mismanagement. I mean, when we're on site with the property managers that we work with, they would know that something like that was going on. They're walking the site every single day. So again, kind of the difference between Class A and Class B is if you have someone on site every day, all day, versus a Class B or C where it's kind of a satellite type of property, something like that's much more possible to happen. Every unit is accounted for in the properties that I'm looking for, at least.
Yeah.
Now, not to say that doesn't happen. So the key is, right, to buy properties that those problems can be taking place. The key is that they're removed so quickly because of the fact that they're on 30-day leases.
Yeah. So the chances with people, you know, having their 20, you know, to midnight rave, you know, and their 10x10 is is really not real likely if somebody's living there, obviously,
or you exactly.
have outside security. Okay. What do you think is the biggest challenge in storage units and operating a successful storage unit facility?
Man, I'd say that, you know, a lot of the mismanagement out there is a result of two things. Just from a big picture perspective, the easiest one is that people aren't aggressive with the rental increases because they're concerned about losing tenants. So when we look at markets, there are markets out there that are significantly undersupplied and also significantly under market rent. So we're not afraid to lead the market. And that's it. And that may be interesting to some people. So if you're ever looking at a pro forma of a real estate deal and you're saying, hey, look, the comps are at $100 a square foot and you're pro forming this at $130, that sounds like you're like, why the heck would someone pay that? But then you look at the fact that the market's extremely undersupplied and, you know, all the occupancy ratings are at 95%+. And they're just like, you know, they based on the metrics and the surrounding income, these units right here should be renting for $130 a month. And I have invested in several properties where we're leading the market. And then all of a sudden the market continues to increase around us. And then also I'd say that, you know, on the more nitpicky type of stuff, the more detail oriented stuff, owning one singular property is going to put you at a significant disadvantage to the competition out there because of the systems in place. The economies of scale, just having the right protocols in terms of management, rental increases, admin fees, late fees, et cetera, it starts to add up significantly. And there are teams out there that can just implement those strategies quickly. You know, branding is really important, building relationships with nearby universities, military bases, et cetera. If you don't have a template in place, it's challenging to come up with that stuff on your own. So that's why I always, you know, preferred the passive investment model, because I'd be happy to defer to someone else's expertise when it comes to something like this, particularly with self-storage. I mean, even if, let's say, for example, that they're taking half the profits above a certain preferred return, you know, I'd have to spend the next 10 years of my life focusing exclusively on self-storage to be half as good as some of these guys. So I think it's a great trade-off for me.
That's great. Yeah, I remember, you know, my earliest recollection of storage facilities actually was as I don't know, 16 or 17 years old, and we kind of got kicked out of one of our garage band garages, you know. And so I think one guy rented a facility, was not air conditioned, and we, you know, tried to make it soundproof and everything, and we'd go inside and have, you know, these rock and roll sessions, you know. And I just remember it just like being so hot in there that, you know, you it just kind of, you know, lost the value of the you know, the whole experience. But nonetheless, you know, that was way back when. I don't even know if they had security. They probably didn't even have security at this facility we stayed at. But anyway.
Do you mean to tell me you're not currently rocking out in a self-storage facility these days?
Nah, you know, they're too tight in the security now. You know, they're actually trying to make money there. So I know, you know, things just change over time. Well, shifting gears a little bit here, you mentioned that you really do a lot of different things in a lot of different areas, and you have people that you advise, obviously, through your podcast. But could you tell me a little bit about your business and what you do there, and what's the focus of your business?
Yeah, sure. So Cashflow Connections is essentially a vehicle in which we allow investors to leverage the relationships that me and my team have built over the years investing for our own portfolio. So I became a full-time investor in 2011 or so, and really just set out to diversify for my own portfolio and for my family. And then as we started to build relationships with sponsors and also put an infrastructure in place in terms of conducting due diligence and underwriting properties, et cetera, and flying to see properties, Cashflow Connections is basically a vehicle to utilize that infrastructure with investor capital. And so we invest in, you know, in each opportunity. And, you know, I'm usually one of the larger investors just because the whole point of the business is, you know, to align incentives and to, you know, prepare for retirement in terms of cash flow as well as appreciation.
Great. Well, we're kind of near the end of our time here. I can't believe how it's zipping by. We have a little section we call Wrap It Up, where I ask you a series of quick questions and you provide answers that hopefully will be helpful for our listeners in terms of resources and various areas that they can improve their real estate investing experience. So if you are ready, are you ready to go ahead and wrap it up?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
All right. Here we go. Favorite real estate book?
Man, I'd say, you know, it's not specific to real estate, but I got to say that Rich Dad, Poor Dad has to start there. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with it. More specifically, The Millionaire Real Estate Investor is also very, very good.
Great. How about favorite business book?
I got to say 4-Hour Workweek. Again, I mean, these aren't ones that are no one's heard of, but I've got to just be honest. And if there's someone that's listening that hasn't read it, I just dropped a bomb on your podcast. So just go and listen to that book right now. I mean, it may change the way you perceive getting things done. And I think that's really what business is all about.
Great recommendation. What about your most valuable website for success?
Man,
other than your own, I gotta say.
I'd say that early on, especially Dr. Housing Bubble, which was, you know, very bearish on the California real estate market prior to the crash. That saved a lot of people I know a lot of money, including myself. And, you know, generally speaking, you can tell from just the podcast, I'm super optimistic about the opportunities that are in front of us. But I'd say that it comes from a place of skepticism of conventional thinking. So Dr. Housing Bubble is kind of a great, it played an influential role in that type of thinking.
Great reference. The first time I've heard that. It's excellent. How about your favorite app?
Oh man, I've got to give Uber a shout out. So, yeah. I mean, that, you know, it's not related to real estate, but it is philosophically like very much entrenched. So I'm very much a proponent of free markets. And I think that capitalism and free markets can solve social problems better than any government or any regulation. And I think that, you know, just to kind of continue that thought, the problem that was created by the combination of regulations and taxi unions that was so serious that people were willing to risk their lives drunk driving was completely solved by freeing up of that market. So while it's not directly related to real estate, I mean, it's a very strong advocation of free markets and capitalism, which I'm a very much a proponent of.
Well, that's a great, yeah, it doesn't have to be real estate focused. So that's great. I completely understand that. What a great resource it is. And it's so amazing. You know, you can everything on your phone there, you can actually see the person approaching your house. You know, I mean, it's like, it's a great app. Great app. How about favorite quote?
Take the ticket, buy the ticket, take the ride. And that's a Hunter S. Thompson quote. And for those of you that don't know, my name is actually Hunter Thompson. I wasn't named after him, but I'm gonna use the quote for this answer of this question.
Okay, well, you actually got into a question I was gonna ask you later, right before we asked people where. Okay, most of our listeners, okay, are, you know, they're baby boomers. They all know who Hunter S. Thompson is. You know, the gonzo journalist, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So there's no relation at all, right? You're not like his kid or grandkid or something.
No, nothing like that. But, you know, I think it's important to kind of put in perspective. So, you know, when I was born, these things hadn't taken place. Like Fear and Loathing hadn't been made into a movie, for example. And so the popularity wasn't such that, like, my parents knew what they were doing, but they couldn't have imagined that it would be the way it was, right? So second grade was like kind of challenging for me because I didn't know what was going on. But I wasn't named like after him. It was like, oh, it'll be cool, it'll be funny. Like, he's Hunter's a great name, whatever. But then, yeah.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. Okay,
sure.
Okay, and our final question on the wrap it up here: if you lost everything you had, I mean everything, and all you had was $1,000 in cash, what would you do with that $1,000 to rebuild your investing and real estate investing business?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that, you know, I've thought a lot about because this is something that can happen to people that are doing real estate in particular with leverage. And, you know, I think that my skill is communicating and selling. So I would spend that $1,000 to get in front of people, to be honest, because I think that I, you know, regardless of money in the bank account, I think that the skill of communicating effectively, I mean, I'm not trying to talk myself up, but just people know where their strengths and weaknesses are. I'm not a good writer, for example. I would never do that. But I think that, you know, getting in front of people and being able to share a product that I'm really passionate about, it would be the way that I would get out of that whole situation.
Great, great answer. I love it. So, Hunter, how are people able to get a hold of you? What's sort of the best way, folks? You know, there may be other questions. There may be people that are interested in some of the things and services you do. What's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can definitely visit me at cashflowconnections.com. And, you know, I've listened to several episodes of your podcast, which is tremendous. By the way, I'm just very honored to be on here. If you're listening to the podcast and you're a podcast type of person, Cashflow Connections Real Estate Podcast, I think that it's going to be a lot of your listeners will enjoy it. We focus a lot on syndications, which is my preferred investment structure, very specific niche type of structure. So that's a lot of really good content. And obviously, you can send me an email at any time at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com.
Fantastic. Well, this is, as you have listened to previous episodes, you do know how we end our you know, this is the part I always tell our, you know, our guests, well, you know, basically any credibility you might have established is just really going to go down the tubes right now. So this is where your closing howl is. Of course, if it's a really good howl, you could end up with a bunch of loyal followers here that will just follow you anywhere. So either way, I'm going to ask you just to go ahead and close us out with your best old hound dog howl. Are you ready?
It would be my honor.
Go for it. Oh, that was sweet. I like that one. That was good. Hope you didn't hurt yourself on that one. That was good. All right, Hunter. Well, Hunter, it has been great having you on. Thank you so much. I mean, I learned so much just in the short time together, and I'm hoping you know, folks will go to your website and learn more about this area and other potential areas for real estate investing. So thank you for coming on as our guest.
Again, Bill, thank you so much. It's totally an honor and really appreciate the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you. Well, I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us, it means a lot, and we really appreciate it. So please note everything we presented here, including the links and some of the references that Hunter made, they can all be accessed in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.